I'm Tim Gombas, and this is Faith Improvised. It's a podcast where I can think out loud and talk with friends about things that interest me. Books, films, sports, music, culture, politics, the wonders and complexities of being Christian in this world, and my academic discipline, biblical studies. You're welcome to email me if you like at faithimprovised@gmail.com. In this episode, Steve and I talk about a bunch of things, but especially about how our perspective on suffering helps us as we move toward wholeness. So I'm standing here in my study. It's been a beautiful day. I'm recording this at night, which is a bit unusual. But I had a bunch of stuff to do today, and that's just how my day has developed. It's been beautiful here in Louisville, although today was quite cold. Felt like it dipped down into the 20s, which is a bit unusual. At least I'm not living in Grand Rapids, Michigan anymore, which got some snow, I believe, yesterday. Not missing shoveling, I must say that. I had a great Thanksgiving. Got to spend several days with my good friends, Don and Becky, and they were so kind to include me in their family Thanksgiving celebration along with a bunch of their friends. Don's band, Saving Pluto, had a show Wednesday night. That was totally fun. And then it was so great to just sit around and watch tons and tons of football on Thanksgiving Day, eat a load of food, and do much the same Friday. And anyway, I just thoroughly enjoyed myself. Unfortunately for the Ohio State fans on Saturday, Michigan won the big game. Came back into town Saturday night and headed down Sunday to Steve's to watch a bunch of football and goof around. And I'm just thoroughly enjoying this time of year, seeing loads of good friends. Got some travel again this weekend on Saturday, Sunday. I'm heading up to Chicago for my great aunt's 100th birthday party, which is just bonkers. There's a lot of longevity in my family. Really on both sides, my mom's family, my dad's family. It's just crazy. But I'm gonna see a bunch of cousins, my sisters, a bunch of nieces and nephews, and I'm sure there'll be, once again, loads of food and a lot of great laughs. So looking forward to that. So just to introduce this conversation, I wanted to pick up on something that Steve had said a while back about how it's helpful to maintain the perspective that everyone suffers. It's just sort of the human experience of being in this world, and that's not exceptional. And I wanted to explore why that is helpful. And I think we talked about a bunch of other stuff too. So as always, enjoy the conversation. So dude, I was thinking about how Sunday, when you put on that Police album, Ghost in the Machine, I was just like, man, just the quality of that album struck me. It all came back to me. Mm-hmm. Like how well they put together albums, like as whole albums. And I went back and was listening to it, and it's like, listening digitally, it simply is not the same experience. And I mean, even in my car, which is a great sound system, I love it. It just, there's something about like the immediacy of vinyl that right. is just, it can't be duplicated, which is like, it just seems so counterintuitive. Like with what they could do digitally, that just shocks me. I don't know why that is.
It's really strange. It's taken me, I've just been on this little analog kick.
Yeah.
Because I'm the analog kid. But no, just that they're all the high tech streaming music and digital platforms and all that. Yeah. And I got that turntable recently and an amp and some nice Bose speakers. And it's like, wow, the depth. There's something, I don't know. I guess the music wizards can tell you what it is, but
yeah, I know.
There's a depth to it.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking it's probably been analyzed and overanalyzed before. I just haven't read up on it, but
me neither.
I was stunned by that. And then also was going back to kind of like what you were just saying, the way that we listen to music nowadays, like I'll listen to this song, that song, and
right.
I remember back in the day putting mixtapes together all the time, like back in the 80s. But it just seems so much more easy to do now that you know, to make a playlist or whatever, or to listen song by song, which I totally enjoy doing. But it's interesting to enjoy certain artists that actually did put together whole albums, like The Police.
I know. You know, that it was a whole thing. You'd listen to both sides, and you'd
immerse
yourself in the music and see the progression of the album. You know, the first group that digitally released their music, they didn't do an album or CD or anything, was In Rainbows by Radiohead. And there, that's another one where you just want to listen to the whole thing. You don't want to snap a song out of there. It's kind of but it's not so common anymore.
Yeah, I know. I have a couple of Radiohead songs in different playlists, but there's nothing like listening to an entire album. And that album is one of my favorites that I always go back to, In Rainbows. It's just incredible.
Enduring.
Yeah, I love it. It's just so interesting that it's funny that you said that, because I just was thinking about how it is that I would play, you'd play a tape and then turn it over and listen to the other side. It just seems so archaic, you know?
Yeah, well.
But it's just, that's how you did it, you know?
Oh.
I had to rewind and all of that. It just,
all your Walkman.
Totally.
But at the time, it seemed cool as beans. I mean, you know,
That's
how I survived family vacations. Just throw my headphones on.
Well, just when you said that, I was thinking about how I think we had a family vacation to Britain back in like 80s, must have been 87, because I had my Walkman and I had a tape. And on one side of the tape, I had 10,000 Maniacs.
Oh,
and
nice.
On the other side, I had Strange Ways. By the Smiths.
Oh, nice.
And just get back in the car after seeing something and put those babies on and be like, tune out my sisters.
Yeah, I was same situation. I remember being my first platoon in the Philippines, deployed over there. We were going through this area of Manila and we were on these buses for like, seemed like an eternity. Mm-hmm. I just kept listening to, like, I had like three Depeche Mode albums, and I was just one side after another, flipping it over, but it got me through.
Yeah. That's so funny. Side one, side two, all that kind of stuff. It's just sort of, I don't know. It is just interesting. Yeah. It's interesting thinking back to those Police albums in that era, you know, when they got sort of that reggae sound on Ghost of the Machine.
Yeah.
Their sound was always so tight. Like there was no air in it. It was all just so tight and clean, which I loved that sound.
Yeah, on the nuggets, their timing was impeccable.
It was exact.
Drum beats were as sharp as the guitar beats and riffs, and it all just, it was very, very tight's the best word. Yeah. It was almost like sounded like a machine playing it. They were so accurate. I mean.
Yeah, just the three of those guys. And it's funny that how their sound developed. And I mean, I'd have to say that really going back, my favorite album of theirs is Synchronicity. And I know, I know their sound changed, but I just dug it. I don't know what it is.
Well, Ghost in the Machine, I think, was you could hear the beginning of that change.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had some songs that were more melodic, more symphonic, you might say, textured and fuller. Rather than that tight rocking traditional bass guitar drums. They started to do synthesizers and became more what we would call going in the direction of prog rock, adding other dimensions to this classic rock. But yeah, you can start hearing it, I think, in Ghost in the Machine. And Synchronicity like blew everybody away. So many great hits, but also just
Man,
the other thing I was thinking about is, man, how many hits? So these bands, these classic bands we grew up on and loved, I'd say from the late 70s to the mid 90s, man, they would just make hit after hit after hit on album after album after album.
Yeah.
Which you think about that today, and they were writing their own stuff. I mean, these are original groups, right? They're writing their own stuff, not some canned whatever. Yeah. But it blows me away. I still can't. I guess maybe everybody thinks that their coming of age time in life had the greatest music.
Yeah.
But I guess that's just the way it is. I'm not going to go off on a soapbox here, but
no, that does. There is something to that, probably, like nostalgia wise. But it does seem like 70s and 80s and early 90s, there was just I don't know, that's just the music I always go back to.
Yeah,
it was just awesome stuff. It was original. There were bands obviously that sounded like other bands, but everybody had their own unique sound. Like, who was doing anything that the Talking Heads were doing? Like, nobody was like
nobody
that.
Nobody. Yeah, so many of them, and so many unique. There's so many different unique influential bands. I mean, we watched the bands out of Athens, Georgia. I mean,
yeah,
B-52s, to REM, to Pylon, to Flat Dude,
and all
Jets,
the ones that nobody ever heard of.
Nobody ever heard of, but were phenomenal.
Oh,
phenomenal.
Totally. Yeah, there was a really rich music scene back in the day in the Southeast, and like all up and down the East Coast, bands would tour that just never really made it nationally, like the Connells. I'm sure there were others, but and who was sounding like REM? You know what I mean? Like, they had their own unique sound.
Totally. Yeah. B-52s too. I mean,
completely. It's so
they were doing their own version of new wave.
Yeah.
Yeah. But totally, even kind of with that throwback look, you know, Beehive hairdos I mean, it was groovy.
Yeah. That's awesome. I'm driving, I'm driving up to Don and Becky's later. So I'm going I'll have to put on all these albums and go back through them. It's just the best.
Yeah.
It's funny because there are so many. So like The Police and like Synchronicity and really their whole body of work. And like REM, B-52s, there's nothing in their sound that dates them. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can tell maybe when they came out, but I was thinking about, I was texting with Riley yesterday about, we were just going back and forth about music that we were listening to, and was talking about the Talking Heads, and he was saying that he just had a conversation with a friend of his. I mean, he's in his mid-20s.
Right.
Like, they're totally into Talking Heads.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's just such an really enduring sound. There's nothing that, like, pegs them to the 80s. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, you can tell that certain stuff came out at certain times, but I don't know. I just think about Bowie's somewhat similar. Like, his sound is just so enduring.
Yeah.
I don't know. I pretty much on every playlist have Heroes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
On there.
Yeah.
I just love it.
So good.
Yeah,
moving.
One of my favorite songs. Yeah. It's funny because, you know, Don's got his band has a show tonight, which will be totally fun.
Oh.
And it's like all the music that they do, you know, it's all covers, but it's just so fun. Yeah. And it's like all the music that they do, it seems like so enduring as well. You know, it's just like classic rock is just, it's timeless.
Yeah, it's why I guess they call it classic, because the classics endure.
Totally, man.
Yeah. It
makes sense. I don't know.
Good stuff.
Anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit about perspective, and suffering, and just how it is that aids contentment, or it aids happiness, or it's like it's such an important component to happiness. And over the last, like, we were going to talk about it last week, but I ended up talking about Johnny Marr, which is fine. There's so much to say.
Typical.
But it's like I've been chewing on that whole notion, and it seems to be so critical. But I just wonder, like, in what ways do you think, like, having perspective, like the perspective about suffering, like that suffering is common to our humanity, like, why do you find that such a compelling notion?
Boy, that's a lot to that question.
Yeah, no doubt.
Perspective, as I'm using the term, I see in a complex dynamic way as things from without and things from within merging and blending inside of me, producing a way I see or perceive reality, or perceive the world to be, or expect the world to be. So there's expectations, there's angles, there's it's a swirl of stuff. And it's why it's really good to wrestle with it, in my opinion, because I think perspective on so many levels can comfort us. Now that we all suffer, I get that from Buddhism. I mean, mm-hmm. my studies in Buddhism, that's a starting point. I would just say on a very basic level, my hope is that if we as a human race are ever going to be, I don't know, not so crazy and not so willing to just blow everything up and kill everybody. And I don't know, maybe this is a Pollyanna way of thinking, but just it's when we start to notice that everybody suffers, right? We're all in this together. And I've said before, I even extend that to animals and to the environment, that, you know, kind of like that groaning for salvation, yeah, that notion in Romans, because it does unite us, because what we all have in common is that we all suffer as human beings. Some suffer worse, some suffer less, but we all can relate to that. And it's a good starting point so that when, you know, I was talking about that, I don't remember if I talked about it on your podcast or not, but when I saw that little kid that was hurt.
Oh yeah.
On the road. I mean, he was just suffering terribly. Yeah. His whole face is covered in blood. Jeez. The guy driving the vehicle died. I mean, it was a terrible wreck. And it was a demographic of a family that were, which is common in this area, of a very uneducated, very, they weren't wearing their seatbelts. just a lot of things that go in a package, that I could guess that on so many levels, politically, educationally, like I would be so far removed from these people.
Yeah.
Almost being snobby, which I don't try to be snobby, but yeah. I have a streak in me that's like, look at this.
Yeah. No,
I start getting cynical and stuff like that. But in that moment, what melted my heart was that they were suffering, mm-hmm. and I did everything I could. You know, I patched him up. I had his first aid kit. Like, I know some stuff about trauma and how to, you know, first aid. And so I was able to help him and get other people helping, because we were first on the scene. I mean, it was just took a half hour before an EMT showed up dude was bleeding out. That caused me a moment of pause to really reflect on humanity and just our common struggle to just exist and stay alive and stay. So there's that suffering can bring compassion, and it can bring a wholeness and a healing on a lot of levels. There's another angle to perspective that I think is really huge, and that is our expectations. All these things play into what I would call our perspective. If I'm expecting one thing, then my perspective on life or how my day goes is going to be affected by those loaded assumptions.
Yeah.
What I'm expecting to happen, whether they're realistic or unrealistic. I'd start with a question. This is a question I've had. I've read about this, but I've scratched my head about this for some time now. Why is it that the wealthiest nations in the world have the highest suicide rates?
Wow.
And the developing world and some of the poorest have the lowest suicide rates?
Wow.
Yeah. That's, I mean, puzzling. I don't know. I've thought a lot about it.
I have to weigh that.
I have to weigh that. Yeah, you got to chew on that.
Yeah,
one.
Seriously.
I've been chewing on it for a while.
Yeah. What do you think? You think it has to do with expectations?
I think it has a lot to do with expectations. For example, when I was in the Philippines, and it's one of the poorer countries in the world.
Yeah.
A lot of poverty. The peso is very weak. That's their form of currency compared to our dollar. On and on and on. But I witnessed this group at the church I went to at the time, in the Philippines, a family who, they had so little compared to our standards. I couldn't believe it. I just kept being blown away by, man, they don't have much to eat. And they would share it with everybody. And they would include, invite me over to their house and insist that I eat equal portions that they eat. Well, I've got plenty of food and plenty of money. But at the same time, some of the happiest people I've ever seen. Yeah. I mean, just giggly happy. I just happy to be alive. I mean, I don't know how else to put it, but it's the darndest thing in my thinking. And I've thought about it. I've never stopped thinking about it. Because they had so little, and yet they were so happy. They had each other, right? They had each other. That's really all they had. I mean, they had some stuff, but gosh, by comparison, like we live like multimillionaires compared to our quality of life. So I think they didn't expect much, right? They didn't. They were happy to have a fish to go with their rice some days, you know, literally.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's changed. You know, I don't know what their economy is doing now. I haven't kept up with all that, but it was, they were very poor. So I think that has a lot to do with it. Because when we live in these societies like ours and Western Europe and places that are wealthy, there's a sense that, well, we're all entitled, or we all have access to this, and we should all have our slice of the pie, or we should all be thriving because it's possible here.
Yeah.
When that's not necessarily true at all,
yeah.
but there's an expectation that's unrealistic. And I think that sets us up for a lot of failure. And I'm not trying to oversimplify this high suicides rates being just a matter of perspective and slash expectations,
right?
Because the two feed into one another.
Yeah.
But I think it has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, obviously there's greater complexity with all of that, but it does raise the question, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, especially, I mean, we may have mentioned this before, but just the role of advertising, or, you know, the ubiquity of seeing all these other, our economy runs on that. Our economy runs on the cultivation of discontentment and desire and desiring bigger, better, more. You know, and only then will you be happy if you have this stuff, and the portrayal of shiny, happy people, who are such because they've bought this product, or they drive this car, or they use this shaving cream or whatever, or a certain kind of deodorant. Those messages are all over the place.
Yeah. And it's hard. It is really hard to be objective about one's culture. Sometimes the best critiques come from outside one's own culture, like by foreigners or people coming from a different perspective.
Yeah.
Because they can shine a light on things that, you know, we only may see the shadows of in our own, you know, being and culture as we are.
Yeah.
But advertising is just, you think about it. Well, I don't care what the product is. You just think billboards in your mind, just generally.
Yeah.
Beautiful people, smiling, happy people, like people in commercials on TV, because I see a lot of these when I'm watching football.
Yeah.
here's another thing that's I just think amazing right now, and this has been going on a while, but how many people, it seems like every other commercial now, and I'm talking network television, I don't have cable, so I'm either watching it through streaming or I'm watching it on a network. And some of the same channel, some of the same commercials come through streaming or network channels, and it's mostly sports for me, is the proliferation of drug commercials.
Oh, yeah.
Like every other, hey, take this for this, take this for this. Yeah. Oh, having this problem, take this.
Yeah.
And, you know, people having apparently bad problems running and laughing and smiling, and you're thinking,
dancing.
It's like, wow, you got a terrible problem. Boy, does that drug make you feel that good about it?
I know. But the whole neighborhood like joins in.
I know. They're all singing and breaking out in this song. When I was a kid, this is just
so funny.
I've noticed they've changed. The rhetoric has changed to this. But when I was a kid, on a plane, I went on my first plane trip when I was probably 7 or 8.
Yeah.
And I thought it was the biggest deal in the world.
Oh, yeah. You had to dress up back in the day.
Oh, yeah. Dress up. You better be on your best behavior.
Yeah.
Shine them shoes.
Yeah.
But they're on the you know, the emergency cards. I was just fascinated because anything visual, I'm reading it. I'm like, whoa. And they have it crashed in the ocean. They have a picture of the thing crashed in the ocean. And these people going down the slide smiling. Like,
yeah, they're loving it.
Yeah. I'm
like, isn't this great?
Right. Sure.
That's awesome. I hope we crash.
You're going to be absolutely. I would die of terror before we even hit the water.
It's so funny.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really funny. All these people are all. I'm just thinking about those drug commercials, and they go through the list of side effects, like get the night sweats and swollen ankles and all the rest. I'm just like, oh my God.
And worse.
I know, possible death. I'm like, God,
yeah,
man, it's just really.
Is it worth it?
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, and we're not even talking about just because we're old. We're not even talking about social media and how like the cultivation of envy and desire. Oh, yeah. And comparison. So to remember, I've just found it helpful for me to remember,
right?
That like everybody suffers and suffering, loneliness, alienation. These are common human experiences, and not everybody, you know, people put their best selves on social media. So when you see something. When you just see a constant array of people being happy or families intact and celebrating and everybody's smiling and everything's great, it's and all you think of is like the mundaneness of your life or the boringness of it.
It's like, why am I not that happy?
Yeah, I know. What's the deal?
But it's just a constructed happiness.
Totally. It's all everybody's managing the perception of their own lives for public consumption, you know, but that just, it just exacerbates that the struggle to sort of cultivate contentment. It's just one more obstacle to overcome to maintain that perspective. Like that gets you that gets your perspective out of whack to just see nothing but a constant array of happy people.
Yeah,
you know,
memory is another one that is central to my idea of cultivating a proper perspective, because it's huge. It's like it's part of I mean it's as important to perspective as expectations and managing those. It's a big one, because we forget. That's why I write down so much stuff that I'll go back and go, whoa, I already forgot this. And it was there was a, you know how I on the evening news on CBS they have attractive people on there, and they're good evening from wherever. It's the evening news with so-and-so. And they always come on smiling.
Yeah.
Looking sharp.
Totally.
And they always go off smiling. Thank you for joining our evening news. We'll catch you here tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yay. Totally. No matter how horrible what they've just had to break on us was, it's like, it's been horrible lately with the stuff that's going on in Israel, Palestine, But there was one clip. It was the morning news. It was a CBS morning news, and it was like, I would watch it back a few years ago. I've given it up. I just, whatever.
Yeah.
And they had one of their lead correspondents, his name Jeff Pegues.
Mm-hmm.
And so they put him as the lead on this. I don't know if it was permanent or he was filling in for somebody, but at the end, you know, he's getting ready to sign off. And apparently, I think this is a second-rate crew. Somebody, he was just on the air, and he had already said, we'll see you tomorrow. Oh, and he's sitting there, and he's sitting there. And then he starts to go. He's really mad. And he was never on that one again.
They
him on another assignment. And I'm like, somebody got a mouthful on that one.
Oh, yeah.
It's funny to see
Peoria.
Yeah.
See the nightly news in Dayton, Ohio from now on.
Yeah. You're going to be in Juneau, Alaska. Well, it was just so funny to see. Okay. He's frustrated like the rest of it. I'm expecting a smile, but reality is breaking through the surface, and he is going to be a hothead the rest of the day, and probably deservedly so. Somebody wasn't doing their job, and he looks like an idiot. He has to sit there. Now he's got to live with it, the fact that he starts frowning on the air.
Yeah.
But all kinds
of typical
like
production
that.
Quality of just everything that you see on television is just so glossy and shiny and Our lives by comparison are just so utterly different, and we feel all of that.
Yeah.
It's interesting how all of that, I mean, I remember when we were part of a mega church back in the 90s in Los Angeles, it was always all about the production quality all the time, because it was in a, not only was it a mega church, but it was in, set right there in Los Angeles where everybody's used to expertly done production quality. So the lighting had to be just so. The music had to come on at just the right time. You couldn't any dead time in the service. Or like if that person's going to give a testimony, like you keep that person to 3 minutes and you've got to make it tight. Transition's got to be tight and all that kind of stuff. And it just leaves you, with a perspective of being Christian or church. As production, as entertainment, you know, like that, this is what my life has to feel like. And then everybody leaves and life
don't
is
feel
just
that way.
Mundane. I know you don't feel that way. My life isn't, you know, my drive home with the kids in the car should be just so. It should be as, the transitions should be just like, I experienced in church, but my kids are, they're out of control. They're fighting in the back seat, you know, like everything's
being
going
kids.
Wrong. But it's like, but the payoff for how I feel about my life is that something's wrong.
Right.
I'm doing it wrong. We're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong. They're doing it wrong. It's like, it's the perspective, our perspective can just get so jacked up by all of that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. And again, go ahead.
No, it goes back to expectations.
Yes.
So you see this performance that's choreographed and rehearsed and is really a show. I mean, and I like shows like anybody else, but, you know, without getting into, is Christianity supposed to be a show? That's a whole other thing.
Yeah, seriously.
But it sets you up for a counter reality so that you go back into reality, which is everybody, the world everybody lives in, and things start flying off the handle and temper tantrums and people get mad. And it's like, it sets up an expectation that is totally shattered by reality.
Yeah.
Once again.
Yep. It's interesting how much we all love bloopers.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, because those are instances where things don't go right. Where someone, watching Curb Your Enthusiasm bloopers, when Larry just keeps busting up. He can't handle when, his Funkhauser? When Funkhauser stares at him, he can't handle it. People can't stay in character, or they break up, and it's just so funny because they're, you sort of get a window into how this is just what it's like for everybody. They're normal.
The same with, like, every now and then I'll be, because I don't get cable, I sometimes go to a sports bar to watch if there's a big game on.
Yeah.
And sometimes they play these people wiping out clips.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've seen those. Yeah.
And I cannot stop cracking at it, because it's like we're so used to seeing the perfect performance and oh, beautiful. The dirt bike that never crashes. But, you know, then you see people doing these, and some of it's pretty stupid stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, trying to run across a rail or something. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is as I was contemplating perspective over the last couple of weeks, what was interesting is when you and I were kind of kicking that notion around, I think it was just, it may have been about a month ago. I think we were done recording and you mentioned it. And I talked about perspective, and what is helpful is the perspective that suffering is common to our humanity. And what's interesting is the more that I've learned about my personality type and done a deep dive on some of those kind of things, one of the internal messages that I can sort of get if I'm not being aware, not sort of like in a healthy mental place, one of the settled feelings that just kind of resides in my inner world is I am suffering uniquely.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So like other people just do not suffer the way that I do.
Yeah.
And to keep, to like actually have that, I mean, and that can sort of have a relationship with a lot of other negative messages that just kind of settle in and permeate my inner world, affecting kind of how I see myself and understand myself in the world and in relation to other people. And to just have that notion in mind, like suffering, like other people are suffering.
Oh,
and
yeah.
some don't suffer like I do, but there are a lot of people that are suffering a whole lot worse. And that's not like looking on the positive side. That's not looking for a silver lining. That's not denying reality. I'm not saying, well, I shouldn't be upset because at least I've got a fridge full of food or something like that. I'm not having to deny any kind of suffering that I've experienced, but to just know that something's not wrong. I'm just like everybody else, and I'm in this with everybody else.
Yeah, that's huge. That I write down quite frequently a couple of things along that line where people, and this is the great thing about, I think, studying the history, the liberal arts, classical literature, even philosophy. You get to know over time, over the big flyover, that, oh my God, things haven't, you know, we just think, oh, to like the artist Vermeer, right?
Yeah.
He died at 43 and he never made any money.
Yeah.
Vermeer, right?
Yeah.
$1 million. I mean, nobody recognized him and he died at 43. And even that, like, I'm in my middle ages now, maybe past that. I don't know. You know, I'm 55. I'm like, man, I outlived Vermeer by over a decade. And it gives me, it doesn't make light of anything.
Yeah.
It makes the perspective is like, holy cow. The sociologist Max Weber, who put a huge, I mean, he was probably, I think some people point to him as founding modern anthropology.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, huge. Well, he quit his teaching post, fell into a deep depression, and couldn't, and was mute on his couch for 2 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that, I mean, thinking, I mean, I've had my bouts where I wasn't seeing the brightest side of life, but boy, not like that.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, Montaigne, he was a great essayist. Like, I love reading his stuff because it's really down to earth. It's not, he's not on a pedestal. He's like looking at bodily functions, the things that embarrass us, like the daily grind of life, which is therapeutic in and of itself because it brings perspective. But he says that, you know, there have been women in small villages living in poverty who have lived such good and congruent and beautiful lives and honorable lives morally in every way that would put Seneca to shame. You know, like these great minds. And I'm just thinking, wow, many, he says, village maidens who have lived their whole life doing nothing but serving their family have lived way more dignified lives than all of these alleged great, you know, philosophers and thinkers and writers and all this. Stuff like that really helps me because it just, I don't know, it just brings a dose of, well, it, you know, if you could look at it one way, it is the suffering of humanity in different forms and making me realize, okay, something's not going just how you want it. A mismanaged expectation doesn't mean I'm broken. I'm any different than the rest of the world. I've got it all wrong, or I've made the ultimate misstep. So that I'm this or that category. So it helps me in that way to think about those things and remember them.
Yeah.
I remembered those just going through my cards the other day. I was like, whoa, I got to set these aside.
Yeah.
And really think about them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. You have to fight. I mean, I've known this, but I feel like I'm always realizing this anew about how it is that you have to fight for your imagination. Because it's being hijacked. This may have been Jenny Odell's book, How to Do Nothing, where she was talking about how attention, we're in the attention economy. And the most valuable real estate right now to like tech companies is our attention, basically our imaginations, our minds. Mm-hmm. And they're fighting for it. They're fighting to determine it and to orient it. And it's all, they're bending it all toward discontentment and desire, you know, instead of like, absolutely. So it's not only like billboards, commercials, it's everything that we encounter as soon as we open up our phones or read an article or whatever. It's like they're going for it. That's where they make their money. And so I'm realizing anew how it is that like, how important it is that I take the time in the mornings to get my mind oriented toward right things, or toward healthy things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can see how healthy of an exercise that is to just write stuff down.
Like, yeah.
Lenny, I don't know.
Because
my mind naturally, my attention naturally goes toward negativity, toward everything that is inadequate or insufficient or about myself and about my life experience. And to get my mind and my imagination ordered toward like plenty and surplus and goodness and joy and delight,
yeah,
takes work. I mean, it's worth it, but it's work.
Yeah. Well, I think that's important too about Odell's book, that that competition for your attention and imagination, I think when it all fails, which it inevitably does, because mm-hmm. we're being sold something that doesn't satisfy really. At the end of the day, it doesn't. I mean, yeah. I can enjoy a nice thing or this thing or that thing, but as long as I don't overrate it and think, well, oh, that's the thing that's making me happy. No, I just appreciate it. It's kind of like the Stoic phrase, learn to love what you have, mm-hmm. not what you don't have. So just love what I have and don't expect anything else. But I also think that is in a partial answer to that first question I ask, why do the wealthiest countries in the world have the highest suicide rates? Because they're sold a lie every day and a lot of people buy it. I mean, I've fallen into it before, but so you got to reach deep to resist it and come up with counter stories and then remember those counter stories.
Yeah.
It's a real discipline. It really is. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what other word to call it.
Yeah.
I tell a story of my own. This is my own story of how a bad narrative I got growing up. So when I was growing up, when I was young, I went to this really progressive school. It was like, it wasn't a Montessori school, but they were outside the box. They didn't have classrooms. They had like mm-hmm. pods, beanbag chairs. It was an exclusive school. It still is. It's thriving, north of Louisville. The teachers were all like hippies back in that day. This is like the early 70s. Yeah. I was in kindergarten, mid 70s, I guess, somewhere around there. They let you learn on your own terms. So mm-hmm. they would encourage whatever you wanted to pursue. So I was always in the art pod, making things and building things and painting things. And there was kids that loved to read. So they were in the reading pod. I wasn't a big reader at a young age. I wanted to see and do stuff with my hands.
Yeah.
Well, the problem was you had to hang with that program for a while. It wasn't designed to be like an overnight thing. The end result is if you hung through all the way through high school and they had K-12, it was in different buildings, but it was a program. And they went on, I mean, the kids went on to elite schools. They did fine. It wasn't like a problem with their methodology.
Yeah.
But what happened was I was there for a couple of years, actually 2.5 years. And then my dad took a job in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and we moved to Pittsburgh. Well, there wasn't any school around like that. And part of the reason, I mean, we weren't super wealthy. The reason I went to the school is because my mom is a teacher and she taught there and I got free tuition.
Yeah.
So there's that. So we end up in Pittsburgh. Mom's not working. Dad's the only one working. So they just stuck me right in the nearest public school.
Yeah.
And it was like, I mean, I thought I'd been thrown into a prison.
Yeah.
But I'm like, I got to. What are these rows of desks and why do we have to sit there and
totally.
Be straight and not look around and not make a noise or anything?
Can't create anything.
My world was being crushed, and I hated it. I hated it. Well, okay, on top of that, I was behind grade level in reading. This was second grade, because I'd been doing artwork. And so guess what? Here comes Miss So-and-so from the special room.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, okay, it's time for you, little Steven, to go off and learn to read while the rest of us do our reading lesson.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the other kids will let you know about that. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
Oh, you go to that room. And now things have changed. It's a little more compassionate.
Yeah.
But I was devastated.
Totally.
And
that's crushing for, like, because you don't have any, well, back to perspective, you don't have any perspective at that time. Like, you just think, and that's your whole world.
The only perspective you have is what your
friends are saying.
Tell you on the playground. Hey, right. Dummy, you can't read. Could you know your ABCs? And it's like all that kind of crap.
Yeah.
So, and I've thought about this over the course of my life. Like later, I've pieced together like what my internal narrative struggles were. So that's a piece. And so talking to my mom, who's a school teacher, like years later, I'm like, remember when I had to go through all that? You know how traumatic that was? And she's like, I said, I was behind, you know, I had to go to the special room. And she's like, yeah, but what you don't remember is you were past grade level in like 3 months. You had passed, you caught up so fast.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, the other but students didn't register. Bother to point that out to me.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I mean, they didn't point out, wow, you really are now a good reader. It was only negative. And
totally.
It was. And so the other Achilles heel of my way I saw myself through many, many years into the military and into college, into my undergrad, was that as a kid, I was super, super curious. Imagine that.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to know, and if something didn't satisfy, there goes my hand. Yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but.
Yeah.
It was my refrain. But, and, you know, what's funny about that is I was truly curious and things weren't adding up. And it's like this with children. If you're raising young children, you know, they'll say, why is this, mommy? Well, because of this. Why is it? Why is that? Well, because of this. Well, why is that the way it is? And then you're like, because that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
You know, but they're into particle physics, like within 3 or 4 why questions.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really asking some difficult questions, but your role is I'm your parent and I know everything.
Yeah.
You get threatened by it. You can be threatened
totally
by that. So I'm always asking these questions and I'm like follow-up questions and I would get all the time and nobody else was asking the question. And probably everybody was thinking it.
Yeah.
And this even went into my doctoral program. When I got into my doctoral program, I asked a question and you know, the teacher kind of looked at me like I was stupid, the professor.
Yeah.
And everybody else, we talked in the GTI room later, and everybody's like, yeah, I had the same question. I'm like, well, I'm glad I'm the dummy to ask it and look like an idiot. But it turns out it was a really good question, and the professor didn't even answer it in the correct way. It was, it was complex. So all these years, I get shut down by teachers that didn't like people with too many questions. Now, some teachers were different. They would be like, that's really good, and you know, they would foster that. But a lot of them shut me down and I end up looking around going, well, I must be the one idiot in the room that doesn't get it all.
Yep.
So all these years later, long story short, I had a real insecurity where I thought I was just dumb, just dumber than a bag of hammers. Like I might as well just go in the military and be a knuckle dragger for the rest of my life. But in walking my first day on campus at Northern Kentucky University, where I took my degree, my undergrad degree, I'm like, it is only going to take a matter of weeks before they kick me out because I'm not smart enough to be here.
Yeah.
So all these years later, I laugh at it all, sort of, but it really had a big effect. And it was one of those narratives that got inside me. Mm-hmm. It took me a lot of work and a lot of thinking to go, wait.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I find that is how my imagination works. You sort of pick and choose selectively. Well, you don't do it purposefully, but like you end up highlighting certain details. Like for you, it was that like 3 or 4 month period in second or third grade where that was such a traumatizing experience. It was such a, it left a lasting impression on you, and you selected that as and like based your built your identity off of that because it was so painful and arresting, and that is out of all proportion to like what is objective and what's real. But that's exactly how like that's how we develop growing up.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. So that you end up telling yourself this story: you're an idiot.
Yeah,
you're inadequate. You'll fail. It'll be a matter of time before we all go out on the playground of life and call you an idiot.
Yeah. You know? And it doesn't just happen that way. I mean, that was my story, and those events were powerful. But I was thinking it can happen in a relationship with a partner where you're being told over and over like a form of brainwashing. You're a piece of crap. You're a piece of crap. You never. And it's like after a while, you start believing that stuff.
Totally, man.
it lives within you. So I'm telling you.
I hear you. No, I know all of that is it. But then it becomes a lens through which you then filter out. Like you could hear people tell you like, God, that was a great lecture. Or I read that article that you wrote. It was really insightful. Like I never would have taken that angle. Like you could hear that, but you filter all that out. And like you select the negative stuff that you hear because of how you've been, how you see yourself. So like all of those other details kind of go together to reinforce like your own narrative about yourself. And I don't know, it becomes powerful. I just know that for myself, that how, and I've done that exact work. I realized that intuitively my imagination had been shaped so that I saw myself in a narrative, a narrative where I was a victim, where I was not getting like what was coming to me. Someone was, you know, my narrative was called lack, and I'm lacking. Like I don't have what I need in my life. I don't have what I need in myself. Like I'm insufficient. It's all negative. And so I started to think about what it would be, how I would think about myself and how I would think about my life if I realized that I'm in a narrative called plenty. And if I'm actually in a narrative called richness, and my identity is gift recipient, and nobody's taking or keeping anything from me, and I have all I need, and all the various people in my life are gifts, and look how rich I am. So it's completely altered the way that I see myself, and it's also altered how I prepare myself, like to encounter other people, and instead of intuitively encountering other people in a self-protective mode, like I don't want to get hurt. I can encounter people in a mode of expectation. Like, what will this be? What gift will this person give to me? Or what gift do I have to offer to this person? I don't know yet, but the encounter will determine that. So it just creates a radically different, that's been a perspective shift over the last, I would say probably 5 years. That's been massive for me.
Huge.
Yeah.
It's like that poem, joy is not meant to be a crumb.
Oh God, dude. Totally.
That's a great poem. It's a Mary Oliver poem for y'all out there. It's so rich and just so brings such perspective to life, you know?
Yeah. Talk about a perspective shift.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, we're in the middle. We're about to enjoy a good season of, you know, perspective and thinking about Thanksgiving and thinking about plenty. I know I'm going to be enjoying plenty of food and plenty of football.
Yeah. What else is there? Food, beverages, and football.
We are, at the end of the day, Americans.
Yes, we are.
That's how we do it. All right, cool, man. I'll probably see you. I mean, have a blast with your family. I'll probably see you Sunday.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, I'm coming back. I'm coming back probably Saturday night, and I'll pop down there and look forward to hanging out.
Look forward to it.
Cool, man.